This is an interview with Alan Beller for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby, and today is May 31st, 2013. We're conducting this interview at the Washington offices of Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton. Mr. Beller, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So let's jump right in. We talk a little about your early life. Where are you from originally?
I was born in New York, but my family moved when I was 2.5 to Philadelphia, and I really grew up in downtown Philadelphia.
Okay. And were you interested in law or securities or economics?
I really come from a family of physicians.
Okay.
My grandfather, my father, my brother are all physicians. I have a great uncle who will practice law in New York, but no, I didn't really have much contact with law or the business world. Professional world, yes, but the business world, no, while I was growing up.
So how did you come to be interested in law?
When I went to college, I started as a biophysics major, and I actually thought I was probably going to medical school. And I got, at one and the same time, it became clear that while I was okay at that, there were others who were much more dedicated to it than I was. And I became more interested in public policy issues. I ended up being an urban studies major with sort of a slant towards environmental issues. And I can't say I knew I was going to go to law school, but I thought when I graduated I would probably go to law school. Real estate, urban studies, environmental issues were probably what I was interested in, but that was my original pathway to the law.
Okay. And so when you got to law school, what did you focus on?
Yeah, well, a little interlude, because I didn't go straight from college to law school. I spent 2 years working in the city planning department in New York City in the last 2 years of the Lindsay administration, and that got me very much interested in real estate, planning. And so when I went off to law school, it was with an open mind, but with that as a plausible direction.
Were there courses or mentors who shaped your direction?
There were mentors who shaped my interest in the law. They actually didn't much shape the direction of my career. I didn't even take securities regulation in law school. but I spent most of law school looking for people who were, at least by reputation, the best professors.
Mm-hmm.
Took those courses, and a man named Bob Mundheim, who has played a role throughout my career, mm-hmm. Bob taught at Penn, but he was on sabbatical my third year, and so the securities regulation mm-hmm. course with Bob was not available. I spent most of my time probably with two constitutional law scholars, Paul Bender and Lewis Pollack.
Okay.
Paul has continued to be a professor. Lou was a professor at Yale and then Penn. Dean at both Yale and Penn, is now a senior judge in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. They shaped my interest in the law probably more than anyone else, and obviously not necessarily in the securities law side.
So,
but nonetheless, I went off to Cleary Gottlieb.
So. Right. I was going to say, so what took you to Cleary Gottlieb?
I'm not sure I was different from many students. What I enjoyed looking at in law school was not necessarily what I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life doing. I wanted a big firm.
Mm-hmm.
The big question for me was New York versus Philadelphia. I went to Penn.
Mm-hmm.
I went to college at Yale, but I went back to Philadelphia for law school. And was married at the time. My wife's also from the Philadelphia area. And we wrestled with, did we want to stay in Philadelphia or did we want to try New York? I'd worked in New York for the 2 years, redecided New York. I wanted a big firm. I wanted a diverse enough practice to kind of figure out what it is I wanted to do. And so Cleary was a very attractive alternative.
What did you find yourself doing there coming out of law school?
I suppose the most important thing about that, my early career at Cleary, is I was in New York for only 8 months when I went off to the Paris office. And so those 8 months were a kind of a typical first-year associate mix. I did a little litigation. I did a lot of work on some secured credit agreements for a troubled company that 13 years later went into bankruptcy and liquidated. It took that long, but they were in trouble or not in great shape even then. That's not fair. I did a public company M&A transaction and a public company offering for the same company in that time frame. Those were my two first securities experiences, but they were not dominant in my that first 8 months.
How did you end up in the Paris office?
Cleary has had for a very long time a pretty substantial international presence and has a policy of sending associates from both New York and Washington to its foreign offices. The non-U.S. offices have historically been staffed with a mix of local law practitioners and U.S. practitioners, and we needed people in Paris, and I spoke, I guess, rudimentary, a little better than rudimentary French. I spoke enough French that they thought I would be okay over there, my wife also, and, you know, I guess in the first in the first eight months, I hadn't committed a felony, and so they decided that they could, with some small modicum of risk, send me off to Paris. We do tend not, you know, we don't send our problem children to the foreign offices because they are small, there's less supervision, you're more on your own, and that was actually part of the experience, if you want to talk about
it. Yeah, I'd like to hear what your experience was there.
It was a 22 or 3 person office when I was there. Only 6 or 7 of us were Americans. Mm-hmm. It was a real French, it felt like a real French law office. And if you didn't speak enough French, you couldn't even get a cup of coffee in the morning. But the practice was broad. I actually spent for about a year and a half. I was there for 4 years. For about a year and a half, my principal matter involved being the litigator liaison with a team in New York when we were representing a French client in a U.S. litigation. I represented the Republic of France and the equivalent of their export-import bank in a U.S. bond offering, but also in a Japanese bond offering. I did a lot of work in the Euro bond market, and that was securities related, but very much not in the U.S. mold. And I did a large variety of other things, a lot of M&A and a lot of other corporate transactions. So it was a breadth of not terribly substantively there was not a lot of substantive legal content. There was a lot of lawyering, if you will.
Okay.
And the way I think of myself having come back from the Paris office in 1981 after 4 years there was I knew almost no law, and I certainly knew almost no U.S. law. My particular area of expertise was the French exchange control regulations. But I had I was confident that I knew what it was like to practice law and to deal with clients. I was much more on my own. I actually, in Lisbon, in somewhere in my third year, was sent down with a bunch of bankers who were even younger than I was to negotiate the first global or international credit agreement between a Portuguese public sector borrower and the international banking community after the end of the Franco and related Portuguese era. So that was pretty big stuff. It was pretty big news. And a third-year associate wouldn't find himself, I think, in their typical New York office doing that sort of thing. And so I had that confidence and didn't know any law, or didn't know very much law.
So where did you pick up when you came back to the States?
I came back to New York thinking probably corporate, knowing corporate practice was certainly what I wanted to do, and had seen enough of the securities world that I thought I could be interested in it. Mm-hmm. I also frankly felt some urgency that I had to learn some law if anybody was going to want to keep me around. The very first thing I did when I got back was I fell into, it was the summer of 81, I fell into the acquisition of Salomon Brothers by Fiber Corporation. It was the first kind of big, it was the first of the big private banks being in effect acquired by a public company. It was not quite what it seemed, because within 2 years Salomon had in fact taken over Fibro as opposed to the other way around, and Salomon Inc. became a very important public U.S. public company. But we were representing Salomon Brothers, mm-hmm. and so I worked on that. I was a senior associate on that with a small team of partners and other associates. That particular transaction was not itself a securities transaction, except in the sense it was a private. It was the acquisition of a limited partnership. Mm-hmm. So. But the target, our client, was a securities firm, and the relationships I started to build there turned into an ongoing representation of the Salomon subsidiary mm-hmm. piece of Fibro, and then as Salomon in effect became the dominant part of that relationship, representing Salomon. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first important investment banking, broker-dealer, securities mm-hmm. law-related client, and it kind of built from there.
Okay.
I guess I've found through my career you make relationships with clients, they become important, and where the client takes you is kind of, in a sense, where you go. You don't. Nobody becomes a real generalist in 2013 anymore, but you do, you develop breadth of expertise depending upon what your client needs, and so that was an example of that at a very, you know, rudimentary and early stage.
Were you encountering governance issues at this point at all, or is that not a concern in your...
I don't think people do... I don't think the term governance had entered the lexicon. I think people thought about whether executives were effective, and I think people thought about whether boards were effective, but I think the standards that people used to measure were very different, and I don't think they thought about the issues in terms of the way we now think about governance issues. There was not really very much attention paid to, was the governance good? There was attention paid to, is the performance good? Mm-hmm. And that was important even then. Mm-hmm.
So you are in the, you're in the U.S. practice for a decade, almost a decade, and then you go overseas again. How did that come to be?
Right. Well, I mean, the U.S. practice, I really did become increasingly a securities lawyer. I mm-hmm. ended up practicing, I ended up for most of that decade having a strong minor, if you will, in broker-dealer regulation and in, you know, trading and in the development of new products for investment banks. The 80s was a time when banks, when the investment banking world really was looking for new products. It was driven in part by the economic environment. I think high inflation and high interest rates mm-hmm. tend to lead to that kind of innovation.
Sure.
Just as I think the current low interest rate environment, you're seeing less new product development in a 3 and 4 percent per year interest rate world than we were seeing in a 17% interest rate world like mm-hmm. we saw in 82, 83, or 15%, 14%. The Tokyo experience was, I'd been a partner for 6 years. We had opened Tokyo in 1987. Ed Green, who was one of our most important senior securities partners, had gone out there mm-hmm. in 87. We were operating under the, with the strategic assumption that Japan would develop important capital markets opportunities and securities law opportunities. That's why Ed was out there, and that's why I replaced him. I think what both Ed and I found, and the firm found, was that while there were significant opportunities in the region, in Ed's case, it was largely in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was largely in Korea and Singapore. There really wasn't much in Japan. But Japan, you know, Tokyo was a certainly a base from which I operated for 3.5 years. We did almost all of the significant Korean privatizations and market opening steps in that period. What really happened was in about 1991, the Korean government decided that the large Korean companies, most of which were government owned or controlled, or at least many of which, needed access to the global capital markets in a way they hadn't had it before. They'd been huge borrowers from the Japanese banks who were awash in liquidity, but they hadn't really been issuing securities anywhere. And having decided they needed access to the international markets, they then decided, well, should we focus on London or should we focus on New York? And to the advantage of Alan Beller and Cleary Gottlieb, at least at the time, I think that pendulum has swung. But at the time, their focus became New York. And so the Republic of Korea started doing, the government entities, the Korea Export-Import Bank, the Korea Development Bank, started doing Yankee bond deals in the United States. Korea Electric, which we did not do, privatized first debt, then equity into the United States. Pohang Iron and Steel, which we did do as Issuers Council, did the same thing. Samsung, which was not government-owned, but was and still is a huge company, did its first U.S. bond offering in 92, probably. And we were in the middle of all of that. So that became a very important focus of my practice. I spent literally months of my 3.5 years in resident in Tokyo. In fact, living in a hotel in Korea. And I spent a lot of time in Singapore because we did the privatization of Singapore Telecom as underwriters council. Mm-hmm. And those were certainly the dominant aspects of my practice out there. I did, in Japan, the work was largely regulatory, helping Japanese financial institutions and foreign affiliates of U.S. financial institutions think about the interplay between Japanese and U.S. regulation and doing some restructuring work. There was some M&A work going on, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. That's what my practice looks like.
I imagine that gave you a good amount of insight into both the U.S. markets and the foreign securities markets. Can you tell me a little about that experience?
It did help. It was certainly a very important part of the Singapore deal. Mm-hmm. Because while the Singapore deal had started out as possibly a U.S. listing, and then a joint Singapore-U.S. listing, it ended up as a Singapore public offering and a Singapore listing and a U.S. Institutional, unlisted offering. But as the transaction evolved, it became necessary to work very closely with the Singaporean government and Singaporean Council to try to meld the two rules together and come up with an offering structure that would operate, that could be executed in both locations. Mm-hmm. That's something that starting in the 80s became an important part of the toolkit for international securities lawyers, and still is. Mm-hmm. Cleary Gottlieb and other law firms with the same kind of profile spend still time. How do we make this Russian offering structure work mm-hmm. for U.S. investors? How do we make this Chinese offering structure work for U.S. investors? How do we make this Brazilian offering work mm-hmm. For U.S. investors? And so this was Singapore Telecom was hardly the first. Ed had done things like that with Hong Kong, and we had done others at Cleary had done things like that with Telmex when it privatized mm-hmm. the Mexican phone company in 1990. or 91. Actually, as I'm talking, I'm remembering there was also a Japanese aspect to the Telmex offering. And so I was recently arrived, and I worked with my partners in New York for a little bit thinking about how to make the Telmex structure work, not just in Mexico and the United States, but also in Japan. So it's an essential part of the of what we do. And there was actually one of my partners at Cleary, a man named Sinemasa Terai, who's now retired, and I wrote an article for, I think that it's long lost in the mists of history, I think it's in the University of Texas Law Review, on the differences between the Japanese and U.S. IPO offering process. So it was something that I was interested in. It was something that was important to the practice.
What were the significant differences? What made companies choose to offer in one versus the other, or to list in different?
Yeah. The I think the key factor is companies. Let me start with a. Probably a hyperbolic premise, but it's nonetheless okay to start with it. If a company can raise the capital it needs in the global market by listing only in its domestic market and then figuring out ways to offer securities around that domestic offering and listing, that's what they'll do.
Okay.
It's what they're familiar with. It's what they know. It's least expensive. It's least challenging.
Mm-hmm.
All these structuring issues I talked about, many of them disappear. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about foreign accounting rules. You don't have to worry about foreign governance rules. You don't have to worry about foreign listing requirements. In the 80s, for most companies in most countries, that wasn't going to work. And so the issue really became London or New York.
Okay.
And for New York and Washington, and in the person of the SEC, worked very hard to become appealing to non-U.S. issuers throughout the late 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And was quite successful. They made their accounting rules a little easier to deal with. They had fewer listing requirements. Some of the disclosure requirements didn't apply to foreign companies. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because this is relevant to some future stuff. When I was asked in the fall of 2001, if I would go to the SEC to run Corp Fin, Harvey Pitt, who was the chairman at the time, he and I talked mostly about two things. One was modernizing the disclosure system. And the other was thinking about how the international system could continue to be made attractive and could indeed be made more attractive. Sarbanes-Oxley made the second impossible. Sarbanes-Oxley was a watershed moment when the United States Congress said, I've never known exactly how intentionally they said it, but to some degree it was clearly intentional. If you look at the legislative history, foreign companies, non-U.S. companies, should not get a break when they come to the U.S. market. And that was a watershed event. So a non-U.S. company looking at the Sarbanes-Oxley environment, looking at the U.S. environment in 2002, or certainly 2003, saw the following. An SEC regime that was no longer as hospitable as it had been for the previous almost 20 years. Two, a litigation environment that was scarier than the environment in London or in other imaginable foreign markets. And three, and most importantly, By 2003, the number of, and certainly increasingly today, the number of companies that can list in their domestic market and have a global, a very large global offering mm-hmm. based on that listing has increased markedly. So, for example, I remember this distinctly. In 2006, I went back to Cleary Gottlieb from the SEC, and like the first week I was there, one of the things I learned about from my partners was we were working on a $6 billion common stock offering for a Brazilian issuer that was listed only in Sao Paulo. Not in New York, not in London, only in Sao Paulo. And frankly, if global institutional investors believe that the Sao Paulo market is liquid enough and high enough quality to support a big global company, that Brazilian, go back to my original premise, that Brazilian company is not going to go list in New York or London.
And that might not have that wouldn't have happened 20 years before.
Never. Okay. Never. What I think you're seeing now is that the listing, the companies that come to the global markets and list there, one, they're still in countries that don't have enough of a local market, and two, there's something about what they do, and there's something about the multiple they might be able to get in a foreign market that's higher. I mean, I'm not an expert. I don't vouch for the proposition.
Excuse me.
But for example, the proposition is out there that tech companies get a higher multiple on the NASDAQ than they get in their local markets. Mm-hmm. And so you do hear of foreign companies coming to list on NASDAQ because they think their trading price will end mm-hmm. up being higher. I have no idea whether that's right or wrong. But the calculus has right. become different in that mm-hmm. respect.
So unless there's other things...
I've taken you far afield.
Oh, no, but we're coming back to... those were questions I was going to ask. So unless there are other things about your first stint at Cleary Gottlieb, I wanted to jump to what you were talking about and what brought you to the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, I had a great career when I came back, by the way. From 1993 to 2000 mm-hmm. and something, I listed some, did some really important IPOs yeah. and had a very interesting career. And I mention that only because when Harvey Pitt called me in October of 2001, this is mm-hmm. about the SEC job, he and I knew each other a little bit. There'd been an opportunity to talk a little bit about disclosure issues after he became chairman. And he called and he said, is there any way I can interest you in coming down to Washington? And I honestly thought the answer to that question was almost certainly no. And it had to do with the fact, not that I wasn't interested in the SEC, I knew it pretty well. Mm-hmm. I had dealings with all of the Corp Fin directors from Linda Quinn, who was there from 86 to 96 on. Mm-hmm. And I had a good deal of respect for the agency. I just really enjoyed what I was doing and thought it was probably the best job in the world. And it took Harvey a month to convince me that might not be the case. And in, I think it was the week before Thanksgiving of 01, so November 20th or something, I said to Harvey that he had made the proposition compelling enough that, yes, I would do it. And as I say, the two things we thought we were going to focus on were the disclosure regime and international. He, at the same time he named me director, he named me senior counselor mm-hmm. to the commission. And people have often asked me what he was thinking and what I was thinking, and I can't promise you I know what he was thinking. But I think it was a recognition that my breadth of experience was really, to a very significant degree, greater than anybody who had walked into a staff position at the commission before, to sound immodest. I've been practicing for 26, 25 years. I've been all over the world. I understood the international markets, or so people think. And I'd done a lot of, you know, I'd done a lot of different things, and it was a recognition of that, and I think the thought was that it would give me, the title would give me the opportunity to be a little bit of a minister without portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
If a commissioner wanted to talk about market reg stuff, because I did a lot of broker-dealer regulation, mm-hmm. what's now trading in markets, or if a broker-dealer wanted to, or if a commissioner or the chairman wanted to, you know, talk about investment management things, and I'd done some of that in my mm-hmm. career as well. It wouldn't be meddling. It would be, and that's kind of what it was. And over the 4 years, I did participate in a bunch of things that weren't involved in CorpFin. It clearly wasn't the major part of my. Of my workload, but it did. And there were a couple of commissioners who quite regularly would ask me, I know this isn't CorpFin, but what do you think of mm-hmm. this? So I said yes, in any event. And what you have to know is that I said yes in November 20th, let's say, of 01. My first day at the commission was January 14th, 2002. Enron had filed for bankruptcy in December.
Mm-hmm.
And the job I had at the SEC was never the job Harvey and I talked about. Even at no point in the 4 years did it ever really come back. There is one other thing Harvey and I talked about doing, which we did do, and we'll get to that, which is to complete the process, a so-called process of securities offering reform, mm-hmm. which we finally passed some rules in 2005. But Enron completely changed the universe. I spent my first day at the commission in Norwalk, Connecticut, which is the home of the FASB.
Okay.
And I would not, you know, if it had not been for Enron, I promise you I would not have been at the home of the FASB on my first day at work.
Well, so if I can jump back for just a minute, you said that with modernizing disclosure and making the U.S. markets attractive, what were your and Harvey Pitt's goals in doing that? What did you hope to accomplish in those fronts?
Making the global markets more attractive, it was pretty inchoate, but we knew some of what I'd been telling you before. We knew that the day was coming when more non-U.S. companies were not going to need the U.S., the New York or NASDAQ market to the degree that they did in the late 90s. We knew that the EU, by becoming a more unified market, was going to become a more attractive market. And so the question was, is there a way for the U.S. to become kind of what really is the linchpin of a global market where everybody will want to come to the U.S. market mm-hmm. because that's where everybody is, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of these, if you build it, they will come
right.
ideas. That's clearly not the vision now.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2004, it was clear it was not going to be the vision in the United States because there was no way after Sarbanes-Oxley you could build something that would cause people to come. Indeed, the opposite was the case. There were a large number of foreign companies who figured out we don't need the U.S. market anymore, and they were leaving rather mm-hmm. than coming. And the net change in non-U.S. listings, non-U.S. company listings since 2002 has been very significantly negative.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we've thought. You know, that was what we kind of talked about,
mm-hmm.
and it, you know, events completely overtook us. Disclosure, where people are still talking about it. There's a provision in the Jobs Act that requires the SEC to do a study of the principal disclosure rules, which are called Regulation SK.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a study. But Alan Beller said he wanted to modernize disclosure. My successor, John White, mm-hmm. said he wanted to do it. His successor, Meredith Cross, said she wanted to do it. Events and bandwidth have really made that not happen. I think my predecessor, David Barton, said he wanted to do it. There are two problems with the disclosure, at least two, maybe more. But one is there's too much of it that nobody really cares about. And not only that, but it tends to obfuscate the stuff that people do care about. And so is there a way to encourage or require disclosure that's more,
mm-hmm.
both shorter and more meaningful? And the second point is, we live in a world of where information is delivered electronically,
mm-hmm.
and yet the SEC disclosure system is still built around a set of forms which are paper forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so every quarter, a U.S. public company files something called a 10-Q, which mm-hmm. is the quarterly report, and it starts at the beginning and it finishes at the end, without any real recognition of, well, this is what happened in the quarter, and this is what's important. And of the 100 pages we just filed, we haven't changed 60 of them since the last quarter. And if all this stuff is being delivered electronically, isn't there a way to just kind of set up a more dynamic way to disclose stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Joe Grunfest, who's a professor at Stanford, and I actually wrote a very short article, and we intended to turn it into a longer article. The short one was published about kind of that question of how you mm-hmm. can update the disclosure regime, not from the point of view of substance, but from the point of view of process.
Mm-hmm.
But that sits out there, too, unachieved at the moment. That's what we were thinking about.
But those goals, so those were derailed. So your first day you're at FASB, and then going forward, what steps did you and Corp Thin and the commission take in the wake of Enron?
Okay. I think it's important to set the stage post Enron,
mm-hmm.
post WorldCom.
Yeah.
Post Enron, there was a very significant negative market and political mm-hmm. reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The politics are very different from what we have seen since the financial crisis of 2008. And the political environment was such that there was, in effect, bipartisan support at the White House,
mm-hmm.
in the Congress, and at the Commission for actions that were responsive to Enron.
Mm-hmm.
There was not 100% agreement as to what those actions should be, but there was 100% agreement that there should be responsive mm-hmm. actions. And my view was that same situation is not there today.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I mention that is within weeks of my arrival, we were focused on a couple of pretty significant initiatives that dominated the first quarter to half of 2002. One was there was a clamor to restore confidence in the market. So what does that mean? The week I arrived, Harvey, the chairman, and the chief accountant, Bob Herdman, announced that the there would be an end to self-regulation of the accounting profession. I mean, Enron was thought of as a massive audit failure. And so one of the responses was the audit profession was until at that time self-regulated, and that in one fashion or another was going to end. We had within, I think it was sometime in early March, and we can find the exact date, but starting very shortly after I arrived, there was the president wanted to put together a program of responsive actions that could be accomplished without legislation. And that was developed at the White House. It was developed with agency input, and it came out. It was actually developed by the president's working group, which was, and still is, I guess, chaired by Treasury, the Secretary of the Treasury, Chairman of the Fed, Chairman of the SEC, Chairman of the CFTC. And that those four people and very limited numbers of their staffers met for several weeks, right about starting very shortly after I arrived. And the result was the president's 10-point plan, which was announced in, I think, March of 2002. And the president's 10-point plan included things like making executives more responsible for disclosure. It included a new regime for accounting regulation. It included, I think it included things about reports of securities trading. And, you know, several other things. The third thing that was on the front of our, on the top plate very shortly after I arrived was the risk of Arthur Andersen's indictment. And that was a Justice Department decision. And, but...
What was the concern about that?
Well, the concern, it was very interesting. Bob Herdman and I were talking, his chief accountant and I were talking about that one Friday afternoon in his office, and it occurred to me that this was Corp Fin's problem and not the accounting profession, not his problem. I mean, Bob was left with a situation. If Andersen was indicted, there was a very good chance that it would go into some kind of wind-down mode, and that would be that. But there were several thousand public companies that are audited by Arthur Andersen whose audits would be due, if they were calendar year companies, their audits would be due mid-April. And we were in, I think, like mid-February at this point. And if an indictment came down soon, and we did not have any sense of, A, whether there would be one, or B, when it would happen. And Andersen was therefore not in a position to complete audits. We could not tell 3,000 or 3,500 or however many public companies there were, oh, well, you can't file your annual reports. You're out of compliance. You can't go into the capital markets. You know, call us in 6 months. And so we had to come up with a set of crisis rules that would allow things to work if the worst case scenario came to pass. Now, in fact, Andersen was indicted. It was indicted much closer to April 15th, and most audits were in fact completed. But we had on the shelf written in complete confidentiality, except for the commissioners who were aware it was going on, and a very small number of people on their staffs and the general counsel's office and my staff and sprinkled around the building, a set of rules which were adopted by the commission on an emergency basis within 2 or 3 days of the announcement of Andersen's indictment.
And those rules were providing a way for companies
those
to...
Those rules provided for a way for Anderson to complete audits if it was in a position to do so, and provided a way for companies to survive and figure out how to switch auditors and do audits with somebody else if there was not a way for Anderson to complete those audits. Okay. And actually, things went off pretty smoothly. So those were the things that were top of mind.
Sure.
Over the first little while. What we then went into, the political environment was both houses of Congress passed, the committee, the relevant committees, House Financial Services, Senate Banking, both by about April had passed, reported bills out that were responsive to the Enron events. None of those bills made it to the House or Senate floor, neither of those bills made it to the House or Senate floor through the spring. And I think we at the Commission were operating on two premises. One, it wasn't clear to us they were going to go anywhere. And two, we had the President's 10-point plan.
Right.
And so what our mandate was to implement the President's 10-point plan. And so you will see, if you go back and look at rule proposals, starting in as early as March, acceleration of reporting of insider trades. The statute, by the way, prohibits that because the statute gives the time frame. So we made a proposal that required the companies to do it rather than the executives. Never got tested, but we had that proposal out there. We proposed a CEO-CFO certification program backed by a robust set of what became known as disclosure controls and procedures, the purposes of which were, in the first instance, to make sure that the CEO and the CFO knew what was going on below them so they could make decisions as to whether or not they knew what they needed to know. And could act on what they learned in terms of disclosure. The commission proposed it was not called the PCAOB. It had a different name and a different acronym.
Right.
But there was a proposal to have a private sector independent regulator of the auditing profession for public companies. And there was a proposal to beef up current reporting, so-called 8K reporting. There were about a dozen different items that were proposed to be added to the 8K list. And we were working our way through that agenda when WorldCom happened, which was late June, 25th maybe of June. And literally within a very small number of days, it was clear that that legislation that had been sitting around in Congress was in fact going to be adopted. And that's what became Sarbanes-Oxley. It took until the end of July, which was a little more than a month, which is not very much time for the Congress of the United States. Bush came out in favor of it within like 72 or 96 hours of the WorldCom announcement. And so that was going to be the law of the land. And in effect, that what came out of Sarbanes-Oxley at the end of the day was very substantially. I'm sorry, that's not fair. There are a handful of provisions in Sarbanes-Oxley that are in fact very close to what we were working on in the 10-point plan. The SEC did not formally have a lot to do with Sarbanes-Oxley. There was some informal give and take, and Harvey had testified, and I think other commissioners had testified back in the spring, and that certainly became part of the record on which Sarbanes-Oxley was built. But by the end of July, the mandate had become not to work on the stuff you'd proposed, but to implement Sarbanes-Oxley, which in some cases was very close to what we proposed, and in other cases was different.
I was going to ask, how did that change? how does the change from implementing the rules that you've written to implementing these congressional mandates change the atmosphere in which you're operating?
I think the biggest difference was in, again, given the political environment in late 2000, the commission, to a person, endorsed Harvey Pitt's statement, because by then we had Harvey Goldschmidt and Harvey Pitt, mm-hmm. so I have to probably stop right. talking about Harvey. Harvey Pitt's position that the commission will do what Congress has told mm-hmm. us to do. We will implement Sarbanes-Oxley, and we will do it in the time frame, mm-hmm. which were by and large 6 months. That Congress imposed, mm-hmm. and that's what we did. So that was the biggest change. I mean, we were, you know, one, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Came, you know, disappeared from the conversation.
Right.
And the time frames became very high pressure, very intense. People worked very hard. Tons of staffers, not just, you know, yours truly. And the commissioners worked right. very hard. I mean, we were sending them 3 and 4 releases a week, and they mm-hmm. were, in fact, making their way through them and giving us comments. And there was a lot of everybody pulling their oar in the same direction. There were actually a couple of things that had to be implemented within 30 days.
Okay. Such as?
One of them was the insider reporting
okay.
rule. I can't remember what the other one was, but in part because we had proposals out, we were actually able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The commission adopted them as temporary permanent rules mm-hmm. while we asked for more comment on them, but we made even the 30-day deadline. The other thing that happened as a result of WorldCom, which I think was very much on the top of people's minds in 2002, but has disappeared from sight, is, and this was Steve Cutler's idea, actually, let's make the largest 1,000 companies certify, the CEOs and CFOs certify using a provision of the Exchange Act called 21A. Let's make them certify that their past reports are accurate. And let's give them enough time to amend a filing to make them accurate if they think they needed to do that. If they thought there was something wrong with them historically, let's give them a quarter to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a due date, which was, it depended on their filing schedule, so I can't remember exactly how it worked, but essentially on August 14th, 2002, a very significant number, like 900 and some, mm-hmm. of the 1,000 largest U.S. companies sent in certifications by their CFOs and CEOs under penalties of perjury
mm-hmm.
that their prior financial statements were correct. And this little exercise, which was designed entirely as a confidence builder, let's tell investors that the entire market is not, in fact, rigged,
right.
Became a very significant media event. There were stories every day, certainly in August, and in the lead-up, you know, what's going to happen? October 14th came and went. 900 and some odd things were filed. There were a handful or two of companies that certified that their statements had not been accurate.
Hmm.
And we did whatever we decided we should do in those cases. Probably can't talk about it. But the vast majority came in with certifications that they were on, that their disclosures were materially complete and correct. And the world moved on. The actual August 14th, which was thought was maybe going to be, you know, a kind of an oh my God day, mm-hmm. turned out to be a very nothing day, which was exactly what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an event that was okay. going on around there at the same time. And the other thing, which is more a Corp Fin thing, but is worth mentioning if you've asked sort of kind of what was going on. Mm-hmm. We made a very conscious decision to focus more on larger companies than had historically been the case. The my way of describing it was I think Enron was commonly viewed as having destroyed $70 billion of shareholder value. Now, it might have been non-existent shareholder value, but it was still, you know, investors thought
right.
they had it.
Right.
It takes an awful lot of small cap companies to blow up $70 billion.
Yep.
And so we ought to be using our review resources with mm-hmm. due regard to that. Now, there's due regard to a contrary proposition, which is even with all that happened with Enron and WorldCom, it is probably the case that there's more bad financial reporting in smaller companies than there is in larger companies, mm-hmm. just because that's probably the way the world works. But nonetheless, the degree of risk as a result
right.
of them. So we devoted, and that continues to be the case today.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing was we decided we needed to focus more on financial reporting.
Okay.
And Sarbanes-Oxley actually picked up on that with the, you have to review financial reports of every public company at least once every 3 years is one of the provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley. One of the things we did over time, because we couldn't do it immediately, but over the time I was there, we hired a lot of accountants
mm-hmm.
so we could do more financial reviews. We got some money in
right.
with Sarbanes-Oxley, which allowed us to hire some accountants. But those are two other things that were going
mm-hmm.
on.
With the other things that were provisions, ideas of expanding the significant event forms, auditor independence, executive certification, were there ones that drew special emphasis from Corp Fin, or was it more doing what was next on
I
the
think document? It was we had to do what we had to do. I think the ones that were the highest profile and which required the most care were the significant event, what you call significant events, which I think of as current reporting
okay.
under 8K. That was an important and high profile event. The CEO CFO certifications and disclosure controls
mm-hmm.
was important. The insider reporting was certainly viewed by the public as very important. It wasn't that hard to do. But it was making it electronic was a little
right.
tricky to do, but as a kind of nuts and bolts technical matter, the audit committee rules were extremely challenging.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons, frankly, was I said to you earlier that Sarbanes-Oxley operated from the premise that foreign companies didn't get a break. And that is, by and large, what we implemented, notwithstanding the unhappiness of the foreign issuer community. And it is what Congress wanted. There was nonetheless, in the audit committee rules, there were some things in Sarbanes-Oxley that were simply not permissible for foreign companies.
Such as?
I'll give you the first example that was called to my attention, which was you could not have affiliated persons on the audit. You could not have people who were affiliates or insiders
okay.
on the audit committee. Under German corporate law, half of the board of supervisors is employee representatives. It's a labor. So the question was, are we going to tell German companies they can't list in the United States because they've got representatives of their labor organizations on their supervisory board and on their audit committee? And the answer to that seems self-evidently, no, we're not going to do that. And so we had to carve an exception out. And there are two handfuls of those kinds
mm-hmm.
of things that we had to deal with in the audit committee rules.
Mm-hmm.
They're enshrined in the rules. We worked very closely with the commission, and we worked very closely with some representatives of foreign companies, both lawyers and business groups. And I dare say the fact that I actually had a lot of experience with non-U.S. issuers was probably helpful
mm-hmm.
in that regard, because I knew that vocabulary. I knew what the issue was.
So, dealing, would you say that with the auditor, the audit committee rules, that international companies pose the greatest challenge?
I'm sorry.
You said you're saying that the audit committee rules were extremely challenging. Was that mostly because of the foreign company aspect of it, or
it was largely because of the foreign company aspect of it? It also, it was very much a sea change, and it was one of the most important sea changes of Sarbanes-Oxley. We're going to put the auditors under the direct control of the audit committee. Mm-hmm. And we're going to make the audit committee made up entirely of independent directors. And in effect, the audit committee became the final decision maker with respect to mm-hmm. financial statement issues. Not the CFO, not the outside auditor, not the outside auditor and the CFO sitting down in the room together and deciding what worked. The audit committee. Mm-hmm. And writing a rule that said that, even though that's what the statute required, mm-hmm. The technical act of putting the words on the paper was not hard, unlike the international stuff. But the kind of the substantive changes in thinking that required and making people get their arms around that as part of the rulemaking process, and making sure that the corporate community, the auditing community, understood what we were doing, that was challenging.
How had things operated before?
Auditors were hired, fired by the CFO,
okay.
or the CFO and his or her team. The audit committee at well-run companies kind of knew what was going on. At less well-run companies, I dare say, didn't know much about what was going on. They had no responsibility mm-hmm. for supervising the auditor.
Okay.
They had no formal required responsibility for supervising that. I mean, there were some things in the listing standards, but they weren't much. And most of the listing standards that tied to the role of the audit committee came in late 2003 as a result of this as well. Not Sarbanes-Oxley, but as a result of kind of everything that happened post-Enron. So that was a sea change.
How much did you work with the exchanges on changing the listing standards?
That was a long process and was probably longer than it should have been. And part of it was we were so busy dealing with Sarbanes-Oxley. Mm-hmm. But I would say sometime by the end of February, we had written a letter, Harvey Pitt had written a letter to the NASDAQ and the New York saying, we need a robust review of listing standards in order to improve corporate governance in the aftermath of Enron. Mm-hmm. And it took them a few months to come back with something. It took us a little while to get our arms around what they'd come back with. We operated under the premise of we wanted them to be essentially largely the same, mm-hmm. but we were not going to dictate to NASDAQ in New York that they had to be identical. Mm-hmm. And so there was this three-way negotiation that took until late 2003
okay.
to come up with those listing standards. Okay. But it started they ended up being an important part of the overall mix, even though it took us a little while longer to get them into place. Mm-hmm. Internal control was also an important
yes.
part of the overall mix. Although that was actually one of the few provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley that didn't have a deadline to it. And so we tackled it later. It was our one, I view it as, I don't mind admitting that I think it was probably a rim shot at the end of the day as opposed to a bullseye. I don't think we missed the target, but I think I think the SEC rule is actually fine. I think the original PCAOB standard was susceptible to having more work than was probably necessary done by the accounting profession, and we know that that's exactly what happened. And part of it was the environment. Auditors were, no auditor wanted to be the next Arthur Anderson, and so they were really, really, really being careful. And it's kind of settled down now, I think. I view it as a very important advance in the world of financial reporting. I think I really do believe that, especially large companies, because controls are, I think, more important the bigger you get. I think, especially with large companies, I think the control environment, and I think if you talk to people who are internal auditors and people who sit on audit committees and boards and they're not rabid, they will tell you that their numbers are more reliable than they used to be.
Now, you said the original SEC proposal was fine. What changed from the initial SEC proposal going forward?
I think the SEC rules as adopted were fine.
Okay.
I think the what the SEC rules did, though, was that they the SEC had to establish the PCAOB, and then the internal control rules authorized the PCAOB to set up an auditing standard.
Okay.
And the rules were pretty open-ended as to what that auditing standard could be. Certainly AS2, which was the original internal control auditing standard, and AS5, which is the current internal control auditing standard, which replaced AS2, both of them fit comfortably within the SEC rules.
Okay. So what was there something beyond those that became what would people see as too burdensome? Or
I'll give you an example of the what was as much change in environment as anything else. In the accounting world, there are two categories. There's remote, and then there's a line, and then there's reasonably possible.
Okay.
Or maybe it's reasonably likely. Let's pretend it's.
And these are that
possible.
An event will occur.
And that an event will occur.
Okay.
The original AS5 said that something had to be taken into account in evaluating the internal control environment, unless the chances of it occurring were remote. AS5 says something has to be evaluated for purposes of the internal control environment unless it's not reasonably likely. Those are identical because you got a line between remote and reasonably likely,
right?
And you're either on the right side of the line or you're not on the other side of the line. There is no doubt in my mind, and there is no doubt in the minds of almost everybody whom I know who thinks about this, whom I've talked to, that the first standard led to much more work than the second standard.
Why?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, because unless it's remote sounds worse than unless it's not reasonably likely.
That's true.
Right? And so we're not going to think about what the words really mean under the rule. We're going to just kind of, get scared. And secondly, the environment changed. In 2004, 2003, everybody remembered Enron. Everybody remembered Anderson. The rule was being administered very strictly for the standard. By 2008... I'm not saying the standard wasn't administered very strictly, because I think the PCAOB continues to administer it strictly, but the world was a different place. But I promise you that that was a change, and while it should not have been consequential, it was.
Okay. Can you tell me a little about the Small Business Advisory Committee?
Yeah, we... that was something that Bill Donaldson wanted to... I should maybe step back. I served under three chairmen. Harvey appointed me. Bill Donaldson came in 2003, early 2003, And Chris Cox came in the fall of 05, mm-hmm. I think, September.
That sounds right.
And I served under the three of them. I left in February 06. Bill was very concerned, as was I, but this was certainly his initiative. Sarbanes-Oxley, particularly internal control rules, but other rules as well, plus some things that had been lying around since well before Sarbanes-Oxley, capital formation for small mm-hmm. companies. Let's take a fresh look.
Okay.
And so the result was we established an advisory committee, which actually reported after I left.
Okay.
But I had a lot to do with setting it up, populating it, getting it started. A Chicago lawyer named Herb Wander was one of the co-chairs, mm-hmm. and a businessman in Indiana named Jim Tin was the other one. And I think if you look at the report, my own view is that it's an eminently sensible report. Some of it has been implemented. Mm-hmm. I mean, the internal control rules were certainly pushed out and pushed out and pushed out for smaller companies, and mm-hmm. under the Jobs Act?
I believe so.
It was terminated. They were eliminated for smaller mm-hmm. companies. I'm not sure in a perfect world that's where I would have ended up, but I understand the mm-hmm. point. And some of the capital formation stuff was dealt with by the Jobs Act. Frankly, some of the capital formation stuff was dealt with by securities offering reform while I was still mm-hmm. there. But that's what that was all about.
Okay.
And there's actually, under Mary Shapiro, with Meredith Cross as director, they did another small public company or a small business advisory committee, which either has completed its work or hadn't, but you know, it's a recurring theme because it's a long-term real problem.
Mm-hmm.
We have a system which, by and large, treats ExxonMobil and Microsoft the same way it treats very small public companies, and that's not necessarily a sensible policy.
Mm-hmm. Going back to some of the Sarbanes-Oxley-related rulemaking, did you find that companies were readily compliant with it, or was it something that the changes were hard to effectively enforce? Maybe enforce is the wrong word.
I think it was more, other than the internal control requirement, I don't think there's very much in Sarbanes-Oxley which is burdensome.
Okay.
And I think corporate America kind of recognize that, and almost all of the, you know, when you hear, and you still hear, when the 10th anniversary of Sarbanes-Oxley occurred, I was on several panels, and mm-hmm. one of the recurring themes was, it's time to repeal Sarbanes-Oxley. It's, you know, it's done, it mm-hmm. cost far too much, and it's done good. And when you actually drill down on that, it was essentially entirely about the internal control.
Mm-hmm.
And you will not get me to say that the internal control requirement wasn't too burdensome the way it was originally put in. I agree. I think it was not. You know, I'd like a do-over. but I think, by and large, it was. I mean, I think the audit committee thing required a very significant change in mm-hmm. mindset,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't burdensome.
Okay,
it produced grumbling. I think CEO CFO. Certification produced grumbling. I'm mm-hmm. too busy to have to read that 10K. That's not my job. Well, as Warren Buffett and I agree, it is your job.
It is now.
well, it always was. So, I'm pretty confident I'm on the right side of history okay. on that one. But that's...
Okay. I think we have a few minutes left. I'd like to talk to some of the other things that happened while you were in Corp Fin, because you did get to some of the capital formation, and especially some reforms in the IPO rules.
Yeah, let me try to address quickly. I think three things that we did when the dust settled
sure.
on Sarbanes-Oxley. The first was asset-backed securities.
Yes.
And we don't have enough time to do that whole subject justice. But asset-backed securities have been with us since the late 70s. They are a... there was a policy decision made, and it started with Fannie and Freddie. Rather than have banks buy and hold mortgages, you were going to have banks make mortgages and then dispose of the asset into the capital markets. That's okay. The way Fannie and Freddie work.
Mm-hmm.
There is a statute that was adopted in the early 80s called SMEA.
Mm-hmm.
Which promoted the secondary mortgage market.
Mm-hmm.
And what had developed, what had developed was a patchwork of non-rules-based processes for offering asset-backed securities mm-hmm. in the public markets. It was largely based on no-action letters,
mm-hmm.
Or it was based on informal negotiations between people at CorpFin and people in the outside world. But it wasn't rules-based. It had exactly zero potential for effective enforcement. And frankly, it gave the high priests who were in the know an advantage over people who could read rules mm-hmm. but didn't know the right people to call, right? And so we made a decision. We really didn't change the requirements all that much. We did mm-hmm. tinker with the requirements around the edges. We made them more stringent in certain respects. But what we really did was just codify
mm-hmm.
The process that had been there. I don't think the outcome of, I don't think the mess with subprime mortgage-backed securities would have been significantly different
mm-hmm.
if we hadn't done it. I think there would have been even less ability to enforce disclosure requirements.
Okay.
There has been limited enforcement action by the commission in the area. I dare say that without Regulation AB, there would have been none
mm-hmm.
because there would have been nothing to enforce. But that's what we were trying to do there. And I think there is some misapprehension that we had some grand scheme. We really didn't. We just wanted to put it down on a piece of paper. Securities offering reform was more ambitious and had some real objectives. The two principal objectives, one of which does relate to IPOs, but also to other offerings. The world of 2005, and certainly today, you can't regulate communication the way you could regulate communication in 1933. You simply could. You can't say to somebody, you can't say something on the internet. Well, you can't, but it's like King Canute,
right?
And so,
right, exactly.
What's a 21st century alternative that we had exemptive authority to deal mm-hmm. with that would allow communications to continue in a more normal way, but which didn't leave investors unprotected.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution was hardly original with me or with us, but we were the ones who got it finally implemented, was we're going to use the 33 Act liability standard around written communications are quote-unquote prospectuses.
Okay.
The problem under the pre-securities offering reform rules is that, with very narrow exceptions, a prospectus has to be the statutory prospectus that's included in a registration statement.
Okay.
And any other writing is per se illegal.
Okay.
And gives the recipient a put,
mm-hmm.
and a strict liability put.
Okay.
Against the seller. What we did was, you can have writings, and we're going to call them free writing prospectuses.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, they have to be filed, and in other cases, particularly where they're prepared by underwriters, they don't have to be filed.
Okay.
But you're going to take the same 33 Act liability for those as you're going to take for the statements you make in the prospectus that's in the registration statement. Which means if you've made a statement, you have to be able to demonstrate that you've used reasonable care to convince yourself it's correct. Or if it's not correct, you're liable for it.
Okay.
Essentially, the same due diligence defense as you have for registration statements. The words are a little different.
Okay.
The substantive impact is essentially the same. So that's one of the things we did. We made the writing rules consistent with an electronic age.
Okay.
So something that's done by email is a writing, but you can also take advantage of it as a writing that's been delivered. You know, a byproduct of this, and I think the thing that actually gave us some political impetus was the Google thing, which happened as we were working on it when, you know, the two Google founders did the interview with Playboy.
Right.
I must tell you, 3 years or 4 years earlier, the consequence of that would have been they have to delay the offering for 40 days. And when I heard about it, what I said was, look, we've got authority. Make them put it in the prospectus. Make them take liability for it. Mm-hmm. They said, why should we do that? I said, because you and I don't want to have to talk about this anymore.
Right.
You're going to take liability for it, and we're not going to hold up the offer.
Okay.
And the new rules are completely consistent with that outcome. They take liability for it, but it's not an illegal, it's not an illegal, prohibited event.
Okay.
The second thing we did, which I think may even be more important than what we did around IPOs, although if the IPO market ever becomes super robust again, my words will be wrong. We deregulated the capital formation process for large companies, large seasoned companies, so-called well-known seasoned issuers, or WKSI, W-K-S-I. And the new rules for WKSIs are essentially immediately effective registration statements, pay-as-you-go fees, no Section 5 gun-jumping restrictions. You don't have to worry about saying something before you file the registration statement. The registration statement can be 2 pages long, and you put all the stuff in when you do the deal. And the guiding premise was simply all the disclosure and anti-fraud and all of those protections remain exactly the same as they were before. But the various speed bumps, some of which were no more than traps for the unwary, are removed. You get the regulatory process out of the way of the process of raising capital. If a big company on Tuesday decides they want to raise money on Wednesday, the market is, assuming they don't have something they've got to tell the market. If they have something they've got to tell the market, then they've got to tell the market, and then they've got to wait until it's in the market, and then they can go. But assuming a company has an up-to-date disclosure record, and on Tuesday they decide they want to raise money on Wednesday, there's no earthly reason that a regulator should stand in the way of that. And that's the premise behind securities offering reform.
Okay.
We did one other thing, which is complicated but worth mentioning, which is the way the liability regime worked or was conventionally thought to work, the registration statement's the key liability document. The registration statement, accuracy of the registration statement is tested on effectiveness. That rule ceased to work once we had shelf registration because it was made effective way back.
Right.
Or at least a year, at the beginning of the time of the most recent 10K filing was effectiveness. You also had the problem that the final prospectus, which was the liability document, was not delivered to an investor until it was put in the mail before closing. But there was no effective practical way, thinking about it that way, to ensure that the investor actually knew what was in the final prospectus when the investor 3 days earlier said, yes, I'll buy.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was, one, we adopted what I think is we've called it an interpretive rule, and I think it's an interpretive rule because I think the statute always should have been interpreted this way. A contract of sale is a sale.
Mm-hmm.
When I say yes, I'll buy, mm-hmm. that's a sale. What I've been told in the combination of prospectuses and oral statements at the time I say that is the package of information against which the liability mm-hmm. should be tested. And if you haven't told me something then, and you put it in a final prospectus that gets filed 3 days later, that's not part of the record that mm-hmm. I have to prove was wrong.
Okay.
That's a very important change.
Yeah.
And we did that as part of securities offering reform.
Okay. Well, I understand we're out of time. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Thank you very much.
This is part two of an interview with Alan Beller, May 31st, 2013, at the Cleary Gottlieb Steen Hamilton offices in Washington, D.C. And where we left off, we were about to talk about executive compensation.
Right. The securities offering reform, which we ended part one with, was sort of one of the things that I had gone to the commission hoping that we would be able to do. While I had been there, it became evident that it was probably time to take another look at the executive compensation disclosure rules that are, for most companies, part of the proxy
mm-hmm.
statement requirements. They had last been overhauled in any significant way in 1991, so it was partly passage of time. I think that's the right date. It was certainly the early 90s. There was some, I think it's fair to say, growing investor dissatisfaction, certainly, with the rules. It's interesting because if you look at the major focus on executive compensation today, and say on pay and so on and so forth, it was certainly not part of the landscape mm-hmm. when we started looking at this in 2005, and I don't think we had any idea that we were sort of at the beginning of a kind of a tsunami mm-hmm. In terms of the importance of the topic. The objectives of the exercise were, in fact, relatively modest when we started. First of all, the old rules, because they talked about salary and cash bonus compensation, including incentive cash, in dollar terms, but equity compensation in share terms, it was apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the single most important, the single most common criticism we heard was that there wasn't a total. You couldn't tell whether Mr. Smith and Ms. Jones were making more or less or the same amount as each other. And so one of the priorities was, let's have a total. That turned out not to be as easy as it might sound mm-hmm. because we had to do something about a methodology for the equity piece mm-hmm. in order to convert it from shares to dollars. Now, you may remember, we didn't talk about it earlier, but on my watch, or when I was there, but more with the involvement of the Office of Chief Accountant, although I was somewhat involved, you may recall that we had put expensing of stock options
Yes.
Back into or into place. There had been a great fight about it in the previous administration when Arthur Levitt was chairman and Lynn Turner was chief accountant. And it actually, Congress ultimately beat back the SEC's desire to expense stock options. Stock options in the aftermath of Enron and WorldCom and the financial fraud crisis was adopted, so-called FASB, FAS 123R. And what 123R did was fair value at grant of the options was taken as an expense in the company's income statement. And we decided, first of all, that was a methodology that allowed us to turn equity grants into from share terms into dollar terms. Mm-hmm. It was an economically justifiable methodology. It may not have been the best methodology for this purpose, but it was justifiable. And certainly no one had the appetite to go back and fight yet another pitched battle to come up with yet another economic dollar-based methodology to value equity incentive compensation. So we glommed onto 123R. And the one change we made, which was somewhat controversial and was actually reversed after I left the commission and then re-reversed back to the original proposal when Mary Shapiro was chairman and Meredith Cross was director, was whether you took the entire value of the grant into account on day one or whether you did, as the accounting rule did, you expensed it over the period of vesting.
Okay.
So if you had a three-year vesting period for financial reporting purposes, it was taken into the expense side of the income statement, one-third, one-third, one-third. Mm-hmm. For purposes of the proxy executive comp disclosure rules, you took 100% at the time of grant.
Okay.
And the theory behind that was the comp committee is making a decision about compensation today. Mm-hmm. Let's put it all in and evaluate the compensation decisions at the time they're made.
Okay.
Or allow investors to evaluate them at the time they're made. So that was one of the big issues. A second issue was, while back in 1991, it was, I think, clearly the intention of the rules to capture all elements of compensation. Mm-hmm. The rules are very detailed. And they're developed an interpretive practice at some companies, I don't think all, I don't even think necessarily most, but at some, where if the element of compensation was styled so that it didn't fit in the box, mm-hmm. in the rule, it didn't have to be disclosed.
Okay.
And that investors were quite convinced that that was happening, and frankly, some of the empirical things that we looked at suggested that that may be happening. When we were early on in this process, I gave a speech out in San Francisco to a compensation-based conference, in which I said the existing rules have to be interpreted as all means all. Those were not my exact words. That was the gravamen of the remarks. And when we put out the new proposed rules, we made sure that it was crystal clear that people understood that all meant all, and there was a column for other. And if you thought you weren't covered by any of the other columns, it went in the other column. And so it was everything was covered.
You're talking about perks and things
now,
like that.
No, I'm not talking about
perks.
You're
not talking
about perks? I'm not talking about perks, because perks was actually the third thing I wanted to mention.
Oh, sure.
There is a column for perks.
Okay.
I don't think we changed the rules, the substance of the rules about perks at all. But as with all means all, we sort of made it clear to corporations that we reminded them as to what the perk reporting rules
gotcha.
Really were. And if you look at the releases The words in the rule don't change very much, but the releases provide some gloss, which makes it crystal clear that the PERC disclosure was perhaps not as good as it could have been as we got further away from 1991 and it was time to come back to first principles. And so that's, we did a few other things. We added some tables. There's a great struggle in thinking about how to make companies or how to have companies disclose executive compensation between, there are myriad ways to pay executives and companies have lots of different ways of doing it. And it's important to understand these are disclosure rules. We were not passing judgment on either the amount or the type of compensation. We were trying to get investors the clearest possible picture of compensation. Investors may disagree that we did a very good job and that it's all too complicated and so on and so forth. But that was the objective. But the there is a choice to some extent between letting investors, letting companies tell their own story as to what they think it is they're doing, and comparability. Because if you let 10 companies put the numbers they want in the way they want, you will investors will find it very difficult to compare those 10 companies. Whereas if you have a standardized set of tables, investors will be able to compare those 10 companies. The companies will then say, yes, but you're not allowing us to explain why our numbers in that table are different from somebody else's numbers in that table. And the way we dealt with that was really twofold. One, we encouraged additional disclosure around the tables and footnotes and so forth. And two, we introduced this concept, and this is the other big thing about the exec comp rules, of compensation disclosure and analysis, compensation discussion and analysis, or CD&A, which we mandated for all but the smaller companies. The theory was that companies were encouraged to tell their own story as to their comp philosophy and CD&A. CD&A, just to drop a footnote, has become a hugely important element of the current debate over executive compensation because it's become the centerpiece of the say-on-pay vote. Companies, obviously, the amount is an important, the most important element of say-on-pay, but compensation philosophy is a hugely important element, and CD&A is where companies are now articulating their compensation philosophy. None of that existed back in 2005, and so we really weren't we weren't writing those rules with that context necessarily in mind. That's what we put out. Okay. It was pretty. It was actually pretty well received. I was the open meeting at which the commission approved the publication of those rules for comment was the last thing I of moment that I did at the commission. It was about 2 weeks before I left, and so my successor John White approved took the final rules through the commission where they were voted to be approved. They weren't very different from what we proposed, and that was kind of it. One of the things I didn't talk about, it sounds like all we did was rulemaking and so forth. A couple, very quickly, two other things. One, we put out, I think, a very important interpretive release in the end of 2003 about management's discussion analysis.
Yes, you can ask about that.
That was, Linda Quinn had published a release, or had had the commission publish a release in 1989, that's kind of the seminal discussion of what we were, the commission is trying to do with MD&A. It's also an interpretive release. This was the logical follow-on.
Okay.
14 years later, we had lots more experience. That was a very important disclosure release around quality of financial disclosure.
What was what were you trying to add on to what Linda Quinn?
We weren't trying to. Indeed, in some way, we were trying to subtract.
Okay.
Because what we were trying to do was get the focus on the more important elements of financial reporting, and stop the rote, you have to talk about everything.
Okay.
And stop the rote, this went up by 1%, this went down by 2%, this went up by 4%, and get more focus on which of those is important, and
right.
then tell us what, why
yeah.
it happened.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? Exactly. And the other kind of important thing, two other important things we did, we encouraged the inclusion of an executive summary, and that is now pretty much universally followed. It was not in existence as a common tool before this release. I think most companies, certainly most large and complicated companies, now use an executive summary. And the purpose is, these are the two or three or four things you really ought to know about how this company operates,
okay.
how it makes money, where it was in trouble last year, and so on and so forth. Secondly, we put a focus on liquidity. MD&A had turned too much into a focus on income statements. Income statements, obviously important. Net income is the number. But liquidity, hugely important. And one of the things we learned in the course of the financial crisis, companies don't go bankrupt because they don't make money. Companies go bankrupt because they run out of money. And that's a liquidity issue. Or they run out of cash, and that's a liquidity issue. And so we focused in on liquidity. And the other thing we did was we frankly encouraged companies to start with a clean piece of paper every year and not to put stuff in this year just because it was there last year. And don't be afraid to leave things. I'm not sure we used the term in the release, but we certainly used the term internally. Don't be afraid to leave things on the cutting room floor if they're not material. I don't, you know, we don't want to see them in 2007 just because somebody cared about them in 2002. And yet the trend had been, and lawyers do think this way, if you put it in, you have to move a mountain to get it out. And in fact, maybe nobody cares 1 year later or two years later. So that was what that release was all about, and it was very significant. The other thing I just wanted to mention, because funnily, we've talked for quite a while about what the division does. The most important thing the commission does day in, I'm sorry, the division, Corporation Finance, does day in and day out is review the filings of registrants. And if the division is, it was 320 when I started, it was 400 some odd when I left because we got some money. Way over half, and probably more on the order of 70 to 75% of the personnel are in the operations division. The job of the operations division is to review filings, send out comment letters, review the comment letters, chase issues to ground, and improve disclosure. And that really is the engine room of the division. And while all this other stuff was going on, every day people are reviewing these filings. And the director does obviously get involved in any very significant number of them, but the important issues do make it up to the director's office, and people talk to me about them, maybe one a month, a couple a month. But in terms of my thinking about what's going on in the division, all the other stuff may be taking more of my time. That's what's really driving quality control in the division with registrants. If we stop reviewing, we would have no quality control mechanism.
Right.
Would have had, and my successors would have. And so we shouldn't leave off talking about my time at the commission and the division without focusing on how important the operations piece of it is.
Absolutely. So, unless there are other things that you'd like to discuss, the only other things I could think of were you made advances in putting the proxy statement on the internet, making things more available online.
We provided for internet delivery of proxy statements. We lived in a world where investors saw their 10-Qs and their 10-Ks and their 8-Ks and their 20-Fs all online. Investors can ask a company to give them a paper copy. It's a relatively rare occurrence. And yet, proxy statements lived in the paper era. Part of that was just logical inconsistency, but frankly, part of it is a for a large company with a large shareholder base, the paper regime was a could be a low eight-figure number.
Wow.
And while that might be good for the U.S. Postal Service and for the printers, it's not good for the issuer community. And so what we decided was we give companies the option to go electronically. Interestingly, for the first few years, not a lot of companies did, or many still did not. I think if you go out and look today, a very significant majority of the companies now operate in the electronic delivery mode. And investors can ask for paper, and some do. But I don't think, you know, I don't think we've damaged the system of shareholder voting by going to electronic delivery, and we've saved some trees and we've saved some money, and that's really what it was as simple as that. That's really what we had in mind. The U.S. the U.S. Postal Service was not happy with it.
I think it's not when you take a couple million pieces of mail out of circulation.
A couple of million, you know, gazillions of pieces. That was what that was all about. I suppose I could mention one other thing. And way back in July of 2002, when Enron WorldCom stuff was at its frenzy, the White House and Treasury had, not for the first time and not for the last, taken aim at Fannie and Freddie. This was before Fannie and Freddie and the financial crisis, but Fannie and Freddie are at the time, they were profit-making. You know, we didn't have Treasury yet. Maybe talk about that in a little while because I had some involvement with that. But they made tons of money. Had shareholders other than the Treasury. They were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And yet they were a class of exempted. Their securities are a class of exempted securities. So they didn't file with the SEC. There was no one who was policing their financial reporting and their GAAP, and they were under pressure elsewhere. We were not the source of the pressure, but we were, at the end of the day, in July of 2002, we negotiated, and it was really Corp Fin and the chairman's office, negotiated a program whereby Fannie and Freddie would agree to voluntarily file under the 34 Act, not register their securities offerings under the Securities Act, but they would file their periodic disclosures. They would file 10-Ks, 10-Qs, 8-Ks, CEO, CFO certifications. Their auditors became subject to all the rules that every other public company auditor became subject to. And Fannie, in fact, registered with its annual report for 2003, at the beginning of 2003, for its results for 2002. Freddie started the process, but in fact did not register until the summer of 2008.
That's interesting timing for that.
But we did accomplish that. I testified in Congress a couple of times about Fannie and Freddie, and it was we also, as I was leaving, did the same thing with Federal Home Loan Banks.
Okay.
They became voluntary registrants. And in both cases, the federal regulator, in the case of Fannie and Freddie, what was then OFEO, O-F-H-E-O, what's now FIFA, FHFA. Okay. And in the case of the Federal Home Loan Banks, the federal, I've forgotten the name of the super, the regulator. There is a regulator of the Federal
Home Loan. Not the Home Loan Bank Board, is it?
It may be.
Okay.
It may be. Anyway, in both cases, their regulations now require SEC filing. So they picked up, and indeed in the case of the Federal Home Loan Banks, we negotiated that with the board, and then the banks came in. So another little, you know,
that's great.
Kept us busy for a few months.
So what made you decide to leave the SEC when you did?
If you'd asked me in 2002 how long I would have been there, I would have given you a number that was lower than 4 years.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know one way or the other, and in effect, one thing led to another. I did really want to do securities offering reform before I left, and. We got to the end of securities offering reform about the same time that Bill Donaldson stepped down as chairman. And that, in effect, probably delayed my departure a little while because Chairman Cox came in and it seemed the right thing to do to be around for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then we got into the executive compensation stuff, so let's finish that. And
right.
So, if you'd asked me in early 2005, would I be gone by the end of 2005, I would have probably said yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The way events transpired, it ended up being fairly, you know, February 2006.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Okay.
It really was, you know, I had actually had a very interesting time. I did, in retrospect, I didn't, you know, what I ended up facing was not what I, the job I took. It turned out, I think, from my perspective, to be much more interesting than the job I took.
So it certainly wasn't what you'd expected.
It was not. It was more challenging, but it was more interesting.
Okay.
And, you know, at the same time, there's a burnout factor. I was commuting, and that was probably part of it.
Okay.
Although I don't think that made a huge difference. I think it was time to go.
Okay. And did you always know you'd come back to Cleary?
The one word answer to that is no.
Okay.
I certainly had absolutely the highest. Effect, you know, I was not looking to leave Cleary when Harvey Pitt called me, and as I mentioned earlier. Thought I had the best job in the world.
Right.
I think I had the second best job in the world. And I always had thought that. So the chances that when I came back out and looked around, that Cleary would be a very attractive alternative. There was no doubt in my mind that that was going to be the case, and it in fact was. But I the biggest question for me was whether I wanted to go in-house. Mm-hmm. As a general counsel.
I see.
And I actually did think somewhat seriously about that and reached the conclusion that I'm better at doing what I do than I would be at being a general counsel. I don't think of myself as a great manager. I like some of the independence that being outside counsel provides.
Mm-hmm.
Took a little bit of soul searching, and I'm confident I came to the right decision. I have enormous respect for people who do general counsel jobs. I think that it's unbelievably difficult, and it's only gotten more difficult. But I also am convinced that I made the right decision, that I would not be as good at it as they are. I looked around a little bit at other law firms, but it's, you know, I didn't go in because I was building a resume. I had a very established practice at a very established place in the legal community. And to go back and be able to build on that with people you knew and respected and had a great deal of, frankly, affection for, as opposed to going off and, you know, starting something all over again. Right. Maybe it's lack of drive or lack of confidence. I don't think so. I think I just knew myself pretty well. And so I decided to go back.
Okay. If we have time, you mentioned when we were talking about feigning Freddie, you were involved in some of the treasure events at the Treasury? Or
yeah, I mean, since I've come back, I've become much less... I did deals when I was younger, and pretty much before I went to the SEC, I did a lot, you know, IPOs for some very, very significant IPOs.
Right.
My practice now is largely non-transactional. I consult on a lot of transactions. People call me up with specific questions. But that's not really what I do. I do a lot of advisory work. I do advisory work for general counsels. It's one reason I respect them so much and think of their job as so hard, to talk to people like me. I talk to CFOs. I talk to CEOs. I talk to boards, advise them. I certainly advise audit committees and auditing firms on audit and accounting issues. It's something that if you'd asked me in 2000 whether I ever would have had enough of an accounting and auditing background to have that as part of my career, I would have looked at you as if you have two heads. But in fact, it became a very significant part of what I did at the commission because of what I walked into.
And you got a crash course in it.
It has become a very important part of what I do. Two of the more interesting things, the worst professional month of my worst month of my professional career, but I was certainly interesting. We were asked, and I was asked to advise the financial advisor to Treasury.
Okay.
In the conservatorship of taking Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship. So in the summer of 2008, concluding just before Labor Day, or maybe right around Labor Day, we were involved in that. And, you know, I saw the next step of Fannie and Freddie was not just being regulated and not just being knocked by the, in the case of Fannie, not just not being knocked by the SEC because of their derivatives accounting, but, you know, taking them into government conservatorship. And then 2 weeks later, I found myself representing the FRB NY, the New York, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in the bankruptcy of Lehman.
Okay.
Which was interesting and immensely frustrating and difficult because, certainly from my perspective, you know, you read the papers and, you know, something could have been done and blah, blah, blah. I got to tell you, from the inside of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that weekend, it didn't look like anything could be done. And so I was involved in that. Two things I'll never forget, although I don't remember them as being great victories in either case. I mean, Fannie and Freddie, we succeeded in doing what had to be done. Lehman just petered out with no alternatives. But that's kind of what I've been doing since then. I do a lot of speaking. I'm on the board of directors of the Travelers Companies, which is an enormously interesting thing to do, and an opportunity that most partners at big law firms don't get to do. And I'm enormously grateful to my partners for letting me do it. But it's been very interesting.
Good. Is there anything else you'd like to cover?
I don't think so. I think that's what I've done, and that's a little bit of what I've learned, and
Great.
Those are some of the accomplishments and some of the mistakes.
Well, I'm glad we could come and finish this up.
Yeah, well, my pleasure. Thank you for coming back.
I appreciate it.